This is Audible.
HighBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Sex, Money, Murder, A Story of Crack, Blood, and Betrayal by Jonathan Green. Read by Keith Sellenwright. Any city, however small, is in fact divided into two, one the city of the poor, the other of the rich. These are at war with one another. Plato, Commonwealth, Book 4. Author's Note. The founding members of the gang Sex, Money, Murder are masters of the art of deception and use violence to propel themselves to the top of a hierarchy. So there are inherent challenges for a journalist seeking to document the truth in their story. Hundreds of hours of digitally recorded interviews with all four of my main sources are bolstered by court transcripts, Freedom of Information Act, FOIA requests, document requests from the New York City Police Department and the Bronx District Attorney, and hundreds of subsidiary interviews. My methodology in recreating scenes of dialogue or action, some of which took place 20 years ago or more, was to buttress face-to-face interviews with scores of follow-up calls or texts to my sources to learn, for example, a particular facial expression, or the music that may have been playing at the time, or any other small observations that enabled me to render these scenes with greater accuracy and detail. Notwithstanding, the human memory is inaccurate and often subjective. Wherever possible, I have tried to corroborate with other gang members or police officers, and in some cases I have had the benefit of old photographs. I have had access to crime scene videos and stills and to police reports, some culled by a private investigator and a lawyer working on my behalf. Requests for medical records, juvenile criminal records, and further documents from the U.S. Attorney's Office under FOIA were repeatedly denied. In some instances, I have used street names or a pseudonym to protect the identities of those in the Federal Witness Protection Program. I bear responsibility for any errors of fact in this book. Act 1. Soundview. The Genesis of Violence. Prologue. The Roof. Up high, on the pebbled tar roof overlooking the projects, Shug took another hit from his blunt. He held the smoke in his lungs, welcoming the rush in his limbs, the warmth over his skin, and finally the numbing of his mind. It would help deaden his conscience for the murder he was about to commit. When Shug allowed the purplish smoke to escape his mouth, it hung briefly like a gossamer in front of the Manhattan skyline before gusting winds snatched it away. It was Thanksgiving Day, 1997. Shug gripped the heavy Colt 45 pistol in his hoodie pocket, warm now after resting in his hand for so long, its weight reassuring him. He let himself stare over the smokestacks and flat roofs of the Bronx to the skyscrapers 2 miles southwest in Midtown, the Empire State, the chrome spine of the Chrysler Building, before turning his gaze to the Upper East Side, the most expensive real estate in the United States, a world created by rich white men and the dynasties that had built America. 7 stories below, at 1704 Randall Avenue, where crack vials littered the ground, he could see the bleak open squares of concrete hemmed in by blank red walls and row upon row of dark, empty windows. Everyone here knew to stay away from the windows. The kids in Soundview called the roof that Shug was on Pebble Beach. A decade earlier, when he was a boy and Manhattan felt like a faraway kingdom, Shug had brought girls up here on dates, looked out with them at the metropolis, and told them one day he would be a millionaire. The brackish air off Long Island Sound was getting cooler. Shug's right lung ached as he held the smoke in. A scar, 10 inches below his armpit, marked where a bullet had entered, burst his lung, and dragged him down into a coma. Now he stamped his feet and rasped a couple of times to help his breathing. Shug was 5'6", a lean stack of knotted muscle. His broad mouth and upper jaw revealed 2 front teeth, with a slight gap set above a defiant, jutting chin. Hyperkinetic, never fully at rest, he passed the blunt back and forth to a tough, sinewy kid called Mac 11, who had earned his name for his skill with a submachine gun. Outside the stairwell, someone had sprayed a familiar tag. SMM. Short for Sex, Money, Murder. SMM was one of the most feared sets, like battalions in an army, of the United Blood Nation. Shug was a general and head of security, and this was his territory, the Soundview Houses. To outsiders, Soundview was a jungle, gang-run, crack-blighted, its residents held prisoner by fear and violence. To Shug, it was a place of safety from the police and rival gangs, a fortress and a powerful state within a state. Randall Avenue was the only way into Soundview and the only way out, as if urban planners had built the place with defense in mind. Inside these walls, Shug's authority was unquestioned. Soundview lived by rules laid down by him and his brethren. Beneath the grid of dark rooftops was a vast market for the crack his crew supplied. The orders that had brought Shug to the rooftop came down from SMM's godfather and Shug's childhood friend, Pistol Pete. Where Shug was raw and forthright, Pete flashed a 1,000-watt grin and then slipped behind you to shoot you in the back of the skull. He was only 5'7", but he ruled the black underworld through fear and a Robin Hood reputation that made him a hero among young dealers throughout the projects. Pete came from an American drug dynasty. His father had worked with drug kingpin Nicky Barnes in the 1970s, and then helped to establish another syndicate in the early 1980s to bring high-grade heroin to Harlem and the Bronx with the Mafia. But by the mid-1990s, Pete's crack empire had made him more powerful and respected in the underworld than his father ever was. And while the Mafia had Sinatra and the Rat Pack, Pistol Pete had New York rappers like Lord Tariq and Peter Guns, who rhymed about his life and crimes. Pete was a celebrity, spending time in clubs with Tyra Banks, Sean Combs, Puff Daddy, later P. Diddy, and the Ralph Lauren model Tyson Beckford. The Pistol was incarcerated on federal drug and weapons charges in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg County Central Jail in North Carolina. But he could dictate life or death in Soundview any time. The week before, he had phoned Shug from jail and said that David Twin Mullins, their friend and fellow gang member, was a snitch. "Twin gots to go," Pete told him. Although it was never explicitly stated, committing the murder would give Shug OG, or original gangster, status. This might mean he'd get his own autonomous subset under the aegis of Sex, Money, Murder. At first, Shug didn't wholly believe that Twin had ratted. For a start, Twin had higher status than Shug in SMM. He was Pistol Pete's partner. He and his twin brother, Damon Mullins, were well-liked in Soundview. And not only was Twin a wealthy drug dealer, but he, too, had murdered for SMM out of loyalty, killing those who had planned to murder Pete. But then Shug stopped himself. You never analyzed, fed your conscience with doubts before a murder, asking why you would kill one friend to remain loyal to another. That would almost certainly get you killed. And in Soundview, you never went back on a job like this. Faking moves got you killed, too. If Shug failed to murder him, Twin's retaliation would be swift. He would almost certainly kill Shug, and Shug assumed they might come for his grandmother, who also lived in Soundview. Over several weeks, Pete had convinced Shug that eliminating Twin was the only way to get Pete out of prison. Twin was cooperating with prosecutors on his case, he claimed, and his evidence and testimony would put Pete away for life. On the roof, Shug pushed away any doubts. He never evaluated the consequences. It simply wasn't in his DNA. The perfect gang member, ruthless, unquestioning to a fault. Twin had to die today. Under his hoodie, Shug wore a bulletproof vest, a Kevlar plate strapped over his chest. He had loaded the .45 with alternating hollow points and full metal jacket bullets. The hollow points would spin irregularly through the body cavity, shredding organs as they went. But if his Mark wore a bulletproof vest, the solid bullets had a chance of puncturing the Kevlar without fragmenting first. Below him, on the large patch of grass between 1704 and 1680 Randall, he could see 30 football players in bright colors warming up, getting ready for the annual Turkey Bowl between the Soundview and neighboring Castle Hill projects that had been a tradition for 5 years. Supposedly this was the one day when guns and animosities between rival drug dealers would be set aside or expressed only through football. Even so, many players wore bulletproof vests. Mac 11 peered over the edge and relayed that Shug's target wore a white Dallas Cowboys jersey with the number 21 in royal blue. Shug tracked several of his SMM allies in on the murder scheme down below. Several of Twin's men, he suspected, were armed and ready to protect him, so some of the SMM men had discreetly positioned themselves directly behind them. When Shug started shooting, a man called Total Package would pass a .38 revolver under his puffy jacket to Green Eyes, another SMM gangster standing next to him. Green Eyes would kill Twin's bodyguard and any of his retinue who might attempt to shoot back. Other SMM members were armed and stationed at strategic exits from the projects, blocking anyone from escaping. The three talked easily with Twin before the game, rocking him to sleep. This was a familiar SMM move. They lulled their victims into a false sense of security with friendliness, masking their deadly intentions before murdering them. On the roof, the wind clawed at Shug, and a thick scar on his head throbbed in the cold. The pain was the legacy of a pistol whipping he had suffered 7 years earlier. Pistol Pete had orchestrated the murder of the culprit who had hurt Shug, so now Shug was going to repay the favor by killing for Pete. On Thanksgiving night, a wind blew over the yard at Cayuga Correctional Facility in upstate New York as Emilio Pipe Romero, an SMM boss serving time for attempted murder, moved through his daily workout. An original gangster, Pipe was the highest-ranking blood in the prison and commanded a powerful and growing army of inmates. Pipe made $1,000 a week selling other prisoners' drugs that were smuggled up from Soundview by an SMM soldier. He also smuggled in Blue Gem Star razor blades, wrapped in electrical tape to slip past the metal-detecting wands the guards passed over all visitors. Pipe used some blades to cut up crack. Others he sold for $25 each. Known as bangers, the blades were the perfect jailhouse weapon for the buck-50 face slashings, so called for the 150 stitches to the face that a victim required, for which the Bloods had a reputation. Pipe cast an eye out to the woods in the darkness beyond the wire. He had been denied parole yet again at his latest hearing. Still, he enjoyed Thanksgiving lunch, the energy powering his workout. When his security detail asked if he wanted to go into the dorms with the 8:45 p.m. return, he declined. The bars were cold to the touch as he used his arms and chest to lower his body toward the ground, then lifted up again. He enjoyed the satisfying burn of his muscles and let his mind drift back to the annual football game in Soundview. He had last played in 1994. Back then he was only 120 pounds, the baby of SMM, and years younger than the rest. But he'd caught several touchdown passes. The year before, in 1993, Twin and Pistol Pete had gone after each other relentlessly. By the next year, they were friends again and business partners, scoring at will for the Sex Money Murder football team. No one wanted to tackle either of them too hard. He thought of the high times with Twin, rolling into the Tunnel nightclub in downtown Manhattan in a fleet of black Chevrolet Suburbans, Mercedes Coupes, and Toyota Land Cruisers. They had a phrase, "Make it rain," and they threw money around like confetti. They bought dozens of bottles of champagne at a time, though they weren't old enough to legally drink. One time, Twin shot dead a man who had been sent up from North Carolina to assassinate Pistol Pete as the apocalyptic bass of Biggie's "Gimme the Loot" reverberated around the club. Twin, Pipe, and Pistol Pete had carried out murders together and shared money, cars, and women. Their bond was stronger than family ties. Now Pipe was hearing rumors that Twin was 999, cooperating with law enforcement, and that he was to be killed. In fact, Pipe's brother, Roe, a young blood looking to enhance his reputation in the neighborhood, had written to him to say that he had almost shot one of the doublemints, blood code for Twin and his identical brother. Pipe knew Twin wasn't snitching. Sometime over the past few weeks, he had written back and ordered his brother to stand down. If Twin were cooperating, Pipe would also be up on a federal indictment, because Pete, Twin, and Pipe had committed some of their most serious crimes together. In his latest letter, Pipe had ordered his brother to stay near the phone so that he could call and explain the situation and give orders. Yet every time he called, Roe wasn't there. Pipe called Shug repeatedly, but he too seemed to be ducking the calls. Pipe had heard nothing from Pistol Pete about Twin being a snitch and marked for death. Pipe tried not to dwell on it, but the feeling of powerlessness was nearly unbearable. He could only hope that his brother and the other Bloods in Soundview would follow his orders and not murder Twin, who was like a brother to him. Pipe had become a sort of moral compass for SMM. He balked at the killing sometimes and urged the younger members to focus more on making money than murder. He reminded them that their purpose was to rise up out of poverty, not to kill one another off. At 9:45 p.m., Pipe headed inside. In the dorms, rows of beds were separated by light blue chest-high dividers. His red slippers were waiting for him, sitting on a red rug near a red towel. He had posted no pictures of family or friends in his cubicle, lest they become targets. Instead, he put up a picture of Janelle, an off-and-on squeeze wearing a thong bikini and crawling on all fours. Running up her right thigh was a series of dog paw tattoos, part of the Blood's iconography. He planned to call friends in the neighborhood after his shower and see who had won the game. As the youngest on the Bronx's new gang investigation squad, 30-year-old Detective Pete Forselli had been ordered to work Thanksgiving. He had been handpicked by the Bronx's chief of detectives to lead the squad, an indication that his reputation for ambition and drive was being recognized by the brass. For the time being, though, the unit was housed in a former closet in the 45th Precinct. Their first target was sex, money, murder. All over the city, the crack epidemic had birthed neighborhood crews who had made housing projects impregnable dominions. From their base in Soundview, SMM had become a multi-million-dollar enterprise that offered murder for hire and cut distribution deals for crack in a dozen cities in half a dozen states. In the Bronx, they were taking over projects like Bronx River and Castle Hill. Forselli's informants told him that there were scores of murders attributable to the group. Forselli didn't like to work the day shift. Most of the action took place at night, when he could jump from murder scene to murder scene, running on adrenaline, and ending his shift when the dawn's first light swept over the city, then making a trip to Gold's Gym. The gym was his sanctuary, a place where he could enjoy his solitude and forget about work and the pressures of supporting his family on a young detective's salary. Inspired by Sylvester Stallone in Rambo and Rocky, Forselli could bench 300 pounds. He had been married for only a few years, and his wife did most of the child care. She would be alone with her 3-year-old daughter and 18-month-old son today on Thanksgiving. This, Forselli told himself, was what it took to be a detective. The Bronx was the center of a homicide epidemic in New York, with more than half the city's murders in the late 1980s and early 1990s. While there had been concern over the killings, which peaked in 1990 at 2,605, they had been largely ignored. Black drug dealers murdering black drug dealers was a problem no one wanted to deal with. Instead, the front pages of the New York Post were devoted to the feds and their elite anti-mafia units waging war on the five families. A recent internecine war among Colombo crime family members in Brooklyn had seen 11 killed, garnering 24-hour news coverage. Yet, in a three-block area in Hunts Point over the Bronx River from Soundview, three times that number had been killed in a few months. The murders of black kids barely made the papers. Forselli had chalked up hundreds of arrests in the southeast Bronx where he'd seen two close colleagues shot and killed. As a housing cop, his was viewed as one of the most perilous of assignments. In 1996, those who lived in New York public housing were three times more likely to be hit by gunfire than residents in the rest of the city. Forselli had started as a patrolman 10 years earlier, and Soundview had been his beat. He'd seen boys in the neighborhoods come of age in the early days of crack, carrying out shootings before they'd been through puberty. They reminded him of child soldiers in Africa, hardened to violence by years of exposure, eyes bloodshot from weed, and unquestioningly subservient to neighborhood gangsters who acted like rebel commanders. Forselli had chased down kids armed with machine guns who had enough money stashed in their apartments to pay his salary for 5 years. Some of them were third-generation Soundview gangsters whose fathers were dead or in prison. They saw themselves carrying on a family dynasty, taking their best shot at the American dream. As he made his way up the steps of the 45th Precinct building and passed through the tall, thick oak doors, Forselli always felt inspired and at ease. The place was a bastion, left over from a time when the rule of law was respected. It reinforced his sense of purpose. In a city where the police were largely disparaged and distrusted, the 45th held its ground. The precinct was sleepy on Thanksgiving. Forselli found his partner and another detective hunched over a little TV watching football. Above the noise, Forselli sifted through the paperwork on his desk, then decided to head out on his own. He climbed into an unmarked Ford Windstar and headed west along the Bruckner Expressway toward Soundview. Today, the gangsters in the neighborhood would be visiting relatives and baby mothers, all the people they might run to if they were wanted on warrants. A few days earlier, Forselli had spoken to John O'Malley, an investigator with the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, and the best detective he had ever worked with. O'Malley was tall and silver-haired, a native of Soundview. He had developed a reputation in law enforcement for equanimity and fairness, and for his mastery at winning the trust of gangsters while getting them working for the prosecution. He had helped pioneer the federal takedown of street gangs in the Bronx, and he had a particular interest in sex money murder because of their ultra-violent reputation and the fact that they were in his old neighborhood. Forselli had talked to O'Malley about a change in strategy in the Bronx. They had gotten permission to prosecute SMM and other gangs under the federal racketeering laws known as RICO, Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, first developed to prosecute the mafia. When Forselli first made detective in 1993, he caught new murder cases every week and got only 4 days to work a case before moving on to the next. For years, Forselli had tried to arrest corner crack dealers and killers, only to see them released a few days later after terrified witnesses in the projects refused to help the police, let alone testify in open court. Even if a jury convicted gangsters, when they went inside, they had their teeth fixed and lifted weights to get back in shape while running their operations from their cells before returning to the street more powerful than before. Now, finally, he had the luxury of time to strategize, investigate, and build a full case against sex money murder. Forselli and his team were now backed by the authority to request the death penalty and life sentences for major offenders. It was all part of a major push by the U.S. Attorney's Office to reclaim neighborhoods from the gangs and to break the generational cycle of sons following their fathers into prison. In Soundview and tough inner-city neighborhoods like it, a state prison term had become a rite of manhood and even held some romance. Using RICO, just as the feds did with mafiosos such as Salvatore Sammy the Bull Gravano, the authorities would offer some street gangsters the chance to cooperate. If they refused, they would go to prison in a place far away from the Bronx, beyond the reach of family, to serve life terms. This was all part of a weed and seed strategy. Once the hardcore gangsters in the neighborhood were swept up and removed, an injection of federal money for social services would help rejuvenate the area. As Forselli slowed and turned onto Randall Avenue, the massive shadows of the Soundview projects loomed over him. On the corner of Commonwealth Avenue and Randall, mothers tugged their children past a few recalcitrant drug dealers in hoodies waiting for passing trade at the spot known as Cozy Corner. Even the local priest from Holy Cross didn't come through here unless he was wearing his clerical collar. Cops at the precinct said you could spot a license plate here from any state of the Union. Today, Forselli ignored the hustlers and instead drove in and out of parking lots, slowly and methodically pausing occasionally to write down plate numbers. He entered the horseshoe-shaped road at the center of the projects and made his way past 1710 Randall. Drawing alongside a small grassy patch between the buildings, he saw young men assembled in jerseys warming up for a football game. He decided to get some lunch. Nothing seemed amiss. He would never have thought to look up to the top of the building where two faces were peering down. Shug saw one of the SMM men on the field looking up at him in greeting. He snapped his head back, walking away from the roof's edge. The crowd from Castle Hill was much larger than he had anticipated, which meant that he could be more easily identified, or shot if he bungled the killing. Shug took a last hit from his blunt to fortify himself. "You ready, Mo?" he asked. Mac 11 nodded, his eager face framed by a goatee and shoulder-length cornrows. He was ready to make a name for himself by killing for sex-money murder. As they moved to the stairwell door, Shug briefly wondered if he'd ever see the Manhattan rooftops again. Then he and Mac 11 vaulted down the stairs, which always reeked of urine, and descended to the ground floor. Outside, Shug dropped his joint and ground it out under his black sneaker. He noticed that Mac 11's face wasn't concealed. "Yo, cover your face, Mo," he said. But Mac 11 was too amped to take advice, focusing instead on his target. "Fuck that," said Mac 11. "We in the hood. Ain't nobody going to say nothing." "Fool," thought Shug as he pulled his hood up and laced the drawstrings under his chin so that only part of his eyes and nose was visible. But it was too late now. Shug needed to focus on his own task. Together they walked directly across the field in the middle of a play before Mac 11 veered to the left. Halfway through, it occurred to Shug to slow his gait, to bounce in on his toes, casually, as if warming up for the game. Twin had just made a play, but was crouching over the ball, ready to snap back to the Castle Hill team. Shug walked up behind him, closing the distance, his right hand around the butt of the pistol. He went through a mental checklist. Was the gun chambered? What was the recoil like so he could be ready for subsequent shots from the blowback of the first? A Smith & Wesson 9mm was tucked into the waistband of his black track pants as a backup. He quickly traced its outline. Just 8 yards away, Twin turned from the scrum to look directly into Shug's eyes. Shug pressed on, pulling out the gun. The long barrel of the .45 got stuck in his hoodie pocket. He fumbled, extended his arm, and aimed at Twin's head. Twin gave a knowing look that would haunt Shug for the rest of his life. Shug squeezed. He didn't hear the crack of the big gun. Instead, he heard the thump of the bullet going low and hitting Twin's body. He fired one more. This time he heard a sharp whiplash report. Then the gun jammed. Panicked, he tried to rack the slide, jiggled at the trigger. Nothing. Chaos erupted around him. Mac 11 had crossed the field to go after the other twin, hitting him in the backside, but after Shug's shots, he blazed rounds indiscriminately. Ephraim E-Man Solar, Twin's bodyguard, started to reach for a gun, but he was too late. Green Eyes shot him multiple times with the revolver Total Package had passed him according to plan, but then he ran out of bullets. Solar staggered, still alive, lunging for Green Eyes' throat. In a frenzy, Green Eyes tried to pistol-whip him to death. Mac-11 gave up chasing the other twin and circled back. He shot E-Man in the head with a bullet that cleaved his skull. In the melee, two other bystanders were hit. Now Twin had gotten up and was running. Shug's heart pounded as if a phantom had reared up out of the ground before him. Panicked at his bungled murder attempt, and suspecting that Twin was wearing a bulletproof vest under his football jersey, Shug realized he had little time if Twin got to a gun.
"Finish him, Shug!"
shouted one of the shooters working with him. In disbelief that anyone would be stupid enough to shout out his name in front of witnesses, Shug turned to shoot whoever it was. In a split second, he reconsidered and focused back on Twin. Shug pulled out the 9mm and fired three shots in quick succession, left-handed, as they ran across the road. Twin, hit in the hand and leg, left a bloody trail. Shug continued firing like a hunter running down a wounded deer. He clipped Twin two more times just before he lurched across Randall Avenue. Twin ran into a patch of lawn before collapsing next to one of the buildings under a window. Shug ran up, and then abruptly slowed his walk in a way that he hoped wouldn't attract attention as he heard distant sirens. But no one was looking. Twin lay in the grass, quivering, staring at Shug with incredulity. Shug, his arm dangling by his side, grasping the pistol loosely, moved alongside and didn't hesitate. He shot once again, the bullet ripping off Twin's nose, exposing white flesh. He fired his last three remaining bullets at Twin's curled-up body. 1. Lil Gunbuster, 1988. Pipe woke at 7 a.m. and admired himself in the bathroom mirror. He wore a freshly laundered white T-shirt, and his skin glowed in the dreary yellow light. Only a few months ago, before he started dealing, he and his brother would sometimes trade sneakers and jeans each day before school to give the impression to other kids they had more than one pair. Today, his profits from crack afforded him a new pair of Reeboks and some skinny leg Levi's. He glowered in the mirror, affecting seriousness. A black shadow was just coming in on his upper lip, and he had the first traces of what would become a thick, wiry beard. He was looking older, he thought, more purposeful. He was 11. Pipe took his name from his mother's former boyfriend, a tall, brawny man with thick biceps and square shoulders known as Lead Pipe. The nickname apparently referred to his endowment. Pipe's father, Big Bimbo, a legend in the neighborhood and a one-time gang member with the Black Spades, a crew that had originated in Soundview in the 1960s before spreading to the rest of the city, did not approve of the nickname. But Big Bimbo had gone in for his second term in prison a few years earlier, and the name stuck. No one could remember Lil Pipe being called anything else. At around 8 a.m., Pipe left their seventh-floor apartment at 1715 Randall Avenue, taking the stairs by habit to avoid the police, who often waited at the ground-floor elevator door. The walls were collaged with the tags of local crews, Newborn Criminals, Soundview's Most Wanted. He pushed open the door to the lobby, smoothed his T-shirt over his chest, and bounced into the low sunlight of an early spring morning. Like most of the neighborhood, the Soundview houses, 13 seven-story red brick buildings in two T-shaped sections, had been cut off from the rest of the Bronx in the early 1970s by the construction of the Bruckner Expressway. The houses were clustered on the western edge of the low-lying Soundview Peninsula, roughly 2.5 miles long at its widest point to the north, where it connects to the southeast Bronx, and demarcated by the Bruckner. To the south, the land devolves into salt marshes at Clayson Point, the triangular tip jutting into the East River. By 1988, the Soundview Houses complex accommodated around 1,250 families, mainly black and Puerto Rican. 3% were white. Roughly 40% were on welfare, and only 20 families had at least two family members working. Pipe's mother demanded that he and his siblings, Roe, Rufino, Eddie, Coan, Geralda, Annette, and baby Chantal, always play within sight and run home as fast as they could when she sent them on errands. The Soundview community was fiercely tight-knit, and the mothers of his friends had free rein to discipline him and his brothers if they caught the boys straying too far. To the east were the Castle Hill projects. Kids from the two projects saw each other as natural class enemies. In the no-man's land between was Adlai Stevenson High School, one of the most dangerous in America. In the 1970s, the Black Spades and Savage Nomad gangs walked the hallways wearing jackets that read, "Kill Whitey." 10 blocks from Soundview on neutral ground was the Kips Bay Boys and Girls Club. The distinctive brown brick building was a safe midpoint where Soundview and Castle Hill kids could intermingle and play sports, largely free of violence, although once Pipe's sister had a fistfight with a girl called Jennifer Lopez, who would one day make her neighborhood of Castle Hill famous. Pipe walked east along Randall Avenue. At the end was a median strip where the kids had set up stained mattresses scavenged from dumpsters that they used as trampolines. Just beyond, in Soundview Park, was a dumping ground called Snakeland, where a boy had had his face blown off by an abandoned gas cylinder. Now it was littered with household trash and porn magazines. Pipe could force his way through to the edge of the Bronx River, a swamp dotted with small islands formed by old refrigerators, car hulks, and, according to legend, the occasional human corpse. He and his friends swam in the polluted water and wrestled horseshoe crabs out of the muck. At around 4 or 5 every afternoon, hordes of rats climbed out of the river and made their way into the neighborhoods. From the shore, the Hunts Point Terminal Market was visible across the river, a hive of belching diesel trucks and the world's largest shipping hub for produce. Pipe passed a few commuters heading toward the elevated number 6 train at Elder Avenue, the lifeline to Manhattan. He crossed the north-south sweep of Rosedale Avenue at the crossroads with Randall Avenue, Cozy Corner. The corner drew its name from a bar that used to be there in the 70s. Along with the pizza shop, there were a couple of delis, a liquor store, the Met Foods, where Pipe worked packing bags, and a methadone clinic. A few doors down was a numbers spot run by the mob. Pipe went into Papa Yala's to pick up coffee, a bagel, and a few Lucy's, single cigarettes, passing a 20 to the Yemeni owner who sat behind a counter running along the right side of the store. Pipe's world was quickly changing, thanks largely to the drug that had arrived at Cozy Corner to take over from heroin. In the old days, men would sit on the sidewalk and play dominoes, drinking out of brown paper bags, untroubled by the pacified users who swayed and nodded out. A couple of years before, Pipe had found his mother, Miss Annette, sitting on the blue shag toilet seat cover in their bathroom, her sleeve rolled up, tying a rubber tourniquet around her arm. "Get the fuck out of here," she said. "Can't you say I'm busy?" He returned an hour later to find her leaning so far forward from a sitting position that he was amazed she was still upright. Pipe helped her to her room. He had learned to walk her to the check-cashing store when the welfare check came, and to take some of the money before she spent it on drugs. When he couldn't catch her in time, the family went hungry. While the heroin trade had been largely controlled by the mafia, who had the resources to buy kilos for $200,000 and import them to the United States, crack was far more accessible. Colombian cartels flooded Miami with cheap cocaine, and a kilo could be had for as little as $10,000 before it was smuggled up the eastern seaboard. No need for massive international networks and large down payments. In New York, a 6- or 7-man crew could set up an operation, take over a block, and turn almost immediate profits. Law enforcement could dismantle centralized networks of heroin distributors, but the diffuse, hyper-violent crack trade was much harder to eradicate. There was no clear hierarchy, no one boss to maintain order. Crack was sweeping through Soundview and rewriting the social contract by the day. In 1988, 150,000 people toiled in the crack business in New York. The parks in Soundview, which had been full of children even during the heroin epidemic, were now empty. The adults who worked regular jobs were captive to the encroaching violence. Many didn't leave their homes from dusk to daybreak, praying that the volleys of gunfire never got too close. Despite Soundview's population density, since crack had arrived, it often looked like a ghost town. One day at the end of 1987, Pipe went to visit his cousin Pookie on the northern lip of the projects. He found him stuffing a desiccated rock-like substance into little plastic bags. "This is the new stuff they got out here, man," Pookie said. Pipe watched as Pookie and other guys filled the bags, and when they were finished, a man with burn scars on his face, known as Crackhead Bemo, shouted up from below the window, demanding bags to sell. Before he'd discovered crack, Bemo had been a young pro baseball prospect. Now he roamed the neighborhood, breaking into cars for stereos and doing whatever he could to get a rock or two, while offering kids like Pipe a start in the business. He became Pipe's mentor in the game. Pipe helped sell crack out of the pizza parlor on Cozy Corner, breaking now and then for marathon sessions with the other boys on the OutRun video game. He held vials for Pookie and other dealers on the block, storing them in a black pouch that hung inside his pants. Crackhead Bemo steered deals his way, approaching Pipe with the money from a customer who stood a safe distance away and buying nickels, vials worth $5 each. For each deal, he earned $2 from Pookie. Pipe used his profits, $20 most nights, to supplement the job at Met Foods. Pipe had a convincing scowl, a father in jail, and a gangster pedigree. He quickly earned a measure of respect. He decided to hustle his own drugs for greater profit with D-Spot, head of a local crew called the Lynch Mob. D-Spot blasted mixtapes from the trunk of his car, often surrounded by young women, and sold blue-stoppered crack vials on the southern side of the projects. Drug dealers took pride in their distinctive colorful stoppers, like the labels on bottles of fine wine, denoting both quality and provenance. By now, Pipe knew all the crackheads. White Boy John, who worked on cars in the projects for a few dollars but now had a habit. Mothers of his teenage friends. Pipe moved more product than dealers twice his age. D-Spot eventually agreed to a 60-40 split and handed Pipe a huge bag of vials. The first time out, Pipe hustled all night, selling 50 nickels. He gave $150 to D-Spot and kept $100 for himself. A day or two later, Pipe brought home a bucket of chicken and a tub of banana strawberry ice cream he'd bought for his family. He handed Miss Annette $75. She ordered him into her bedroom out of earshot while his siblings ate. "Where did you get this money from?" she demanded. "Ain't no way in hell you pack no bags and you able to buy all this food and give me $75. Pipe invented an excuse, and Miss Annette, whether she believed it or not, abruptly left the matter alone. For their own reasons, neither of them wanted to get into a conversation about drugs, whether about using them or selling them. By the time Pipe quit the job at the supermarket to focus on drug dealing full-time, he had noticed that even some once respectable people, like a supervisor there, had the glassy look of a crack smoker. By the age of 11, Pipe was the man of the house. He wasn't sure what it meant, but that was how his mother began referring to him. He watched The Cosby Show on the black-and-white TV with the coat hanger as an aerial from the top bunk in his bedroom. Pipe modeled himself on Dr. Huxtable and thought he might become a doctor one day, living in a brownstone townhouse. He helped his younger siblings with their homework and made them dinner when they got home from school, sometimes mayonnaise or syrup sandwiches, or rice with margarine. This was if they hadn't blown their $65 in food stamps, which arrived in a blue-and-white book around the 5th of each month, in the Chinese restaurant on Commonwealth. On those days, Pipe headed down to the community center on Seward Avenue to the north of the projects and picked up a large welfare cheese, which he brought home and grilled to perfection. Pipe eased through the apartment door backward so as not to spill the coffee. He moved past the cramped kitchen, down a long, dark hallway to his mother's room. He pushed the coffee into her hand and laid the bagel on the bedside table with the cigarettes. Still in bed, with the curtain drawn, she mumbled thanks, her smile revealing dimples, a family trait. Pipe thought of dropping a couple of extra 20s beside her, but though she let Pipe buy food and cigarettes, she mostly refused his profits from dealing. He remembered a day 3 years ago when he was 8. He and his mother stood on the sidewalk as a shimmering forest-green Cadillac with fins and chrome rims drifted around the corner and slowed to a halt in front of them, lead pipe at the wheel. They headed off to the Cross County Mall in Yonkers. When they arrived, lead pipe parked outside the glass doors leading into Macy's and kept the engine running. Inside, Pipe's mother unfurled a few Macy's bags from within her coat and, after quickly scanning the aisles for security guards, began to load them with clothes, perfume, and designer goods from different departments. When they were full, she handed them to Pipe, who carried them to the waiting Cadillac. Sometimes his mother stole to order for people in the neighborhood in return for money to get heroin. Other times it was for the family or herself. Only a few weeks after Lead Pipe drove them to Macy's, a security guard pounced after Miss Annette picked out a couple of suits and lingered too long in another aisle. Undeterred, she pushed the bags into Pipe's arms, told him to run, and blocked the guard. Pipe ran through the doors and launched his little body into the back seat of Lead Pipe's car with the poise of an Olympic diver. In halting breaths, he told Lead Pipe what had happened. Pipe's mother slipped into the car an hour later, tousled and agitated, ordering Lead Pipe to drive home. Eventually, she was arrested for shoplifting, leaving Pipe home to take care of the family alone. She was sentenced to 6 months in jail. Within days, two police officers and a woman from social services cornered Pipe outside the apartment and marched him inside. The children were forced to get dressed, then escorted to the front of the building to await the car that would take them to foster care. Pipe and his sister, Annette, locked eyes and took off, heads down, little fists pumping, making a break north to Seward Avenue, where they burst out of the projects. Pipe surged ahead, vaulting a chain-link fence. On the other side, he turned his head to see Annette with the police. She screamed for her brother. Pipe looked north along the avenue to freedom, hesitated, then reluctantly scuffed back to the police officers and his sister. Within a few days, Pipe and Roe, born 9 months after Pipe, arrived at the first of several foster homes run by a kindly woman named Mrs. Brown, who owned a two-family house with a backyard. She took the boys to church every Sunday, ensured that they did their homework, and assigned light household chores. Pipe began to excel at school, making the honor roll, and for a while, he was free to be a child. He and his siblings were returned to Soundview sometime in 1986. Elated to see his mother, Pipe was soon saddled again with all the tasks of a parent. On one hand, he was glad to be needed and to be back with his mother. On the other, he missed the freedom of life with Mrs. Brown. After dropping the coffee and cigarettes at his mother's bedside, Pipe headed off to IS-174, a windowless junior high on White Plains Road about 15 minutes away, at around 8:30 a.m. He met a friend on the corner of Taylor Avenue, and they lit a blunt and passed it between them as they walked to school. By the time they got there, Pipe was hungry. At a store opposite the school, the boys bought Heroes for $1. Some girls arrived. Pipe grabbed a couple of them on the backside, only to receive a slap or an angry pout. At 8:45 a.m., he learned that there were no tests that day. No point in being at school. He returned to the pizza joint at Cozy Corner to try to sell his last ounce of crack. At around noon, he bumped into a cousin of his friend Pete. The girl said that Pete wanted to see him, so Pipe went home and at 2 o'clock set off through the projects to Pete's apartment. Pete thrived on trouble. Violent fights. Drug debts. Pipe's mind raced. The two had met a year before at Pipe's cousin's apartment, and despite the age gap, Pete was 14, they had bonded quickly. With Pete, he could relax into his 11-year-old self and let someone else be the authority. Also, Pete didn't struggle like the Soundview kids, exuding an air of prosperity that Pipe admired. He'd been schooled privately at St. Raymond Elementary. Compared to Pipe, he enjoyed a luxurious life with a well-heeled family that wanted for little. He always had the latest sneakers, computer games, and BMX bikes, and he liked being the center of attention. Quickly, Pete was becoming the big brother that Pipe had never had. Pipe cut northwest. A boombox pulsed gangster rap as he caught sight of the Lafayette Boynton houses, co-ops and rentals for lower and middle-income earners. He was buzzed in at 875 Boynton and went to the ninth floor, where Pete met him at the door, shirtless and shoeless, in shorts. Pete was well-nourished, with chipmunk cheeks, straight white teeth, and soft, buttery skin. Pete had been teaching Pipe how to box, to put his hands up to protect his chin and temples and to snap down on punches. On the way into the apartment, Pete threw a flurry of playful punches before easing off. His motocross bike was parked on the balcony. He boasted that he had stolen it from some white kids in Soundview Park. He had shown Pipe how to sit on it, how to twist the throttle gently while easing off on the clutch. Pete had watched him blasting along the banks of the Bronx River with the wind in his face. Pete was teaching him everything he knew. Some nights, Pipe slept on the floor of Pete's room next to his bed. Pipe had gotten into some trouble at his school after he beat up a Hispanic kid who went home and told his older cousins. The boys had waited outside the school for Pipe, who had slipped out unseen and told Pete about it. The following day, Pete and his friend B-Love showed up at the school. B-Love had broad features, bright eyes, and a wide, dopey grin. Pete and B-Love ambushed the Hispanic boys and gave them a fierce beating. For the first time in Pipe's life, someone had stood up for him. But more than that, Pete chose Pipe over the others. In February, Pipe had spotted B-Love emerging from the ground floor bedroom window of Pete's girlfriend's apartment and reported this to Pete. Pete said that he'd come straight down in a cab and sort out the situation. When he arrived, he found B-Love jumping Pipe. Pete punched B-Love in the face. "Don't you ever violate my little brother again," he said. "He's family." Pipe still didn't know why he'd been summoned today. Pete handed him a strawberry Pop-Tart from an overstocked fridge, and the two boys collapsed on the sofa and played Sega for a while until the phone rang. When Pete hung up, he told Pipe he had a proposition. Some local kids were hustling crack in the Lafayette houses on the spot that Pete's friend, a rival dealer, wanted to control. They were taking his customers, costing him money. Somebody needed to scare them off with a gun. The dealer was offering 250 grams of crack in payment. Pete offered 100 grams as bounty if Pipe wanted to do it. Pipe said that he would do the job on his way home, and Pete ushered him into his makeshift bedroom. His mother, Ma Brenda, had hung a large curtain to separate his space from the living room. On a wall inside was a shrine to various mafiosi, posters of Albert Mad Hatter Anastasia, who ran the brutal enforcement arm of the mafia, Murder, Inc., so ruthlessly he became known as Lord High Executioner, Carmine the Cigar Galante, head of the Bonanno crime family, Nicky Scarfo, head of the Philadelphia mob, and Lucky Luciano, godfather of the five families in New York City. Pete rummaged in a small plastic chest at the foot of the bed, pushing aside T-shirts and hoodies and musty old football gear. "There," he said, holding aloft a black revolver. The first time Pipe had come to the apartment, Pete had sworn him to secrecy, then produced a sawed-off .30-30 rifle from under his mattress. He'd showed Pipe how long the bullets were, and consequently, how deadly. Pete had dropped a round into the chamber, let him hold it. "Do you want to shoot it off the terrace?" he had asked with a sly grin. Pipe had declined. Now he handed Pipe the revolver, .22 caliber with a polished wooden handle. Pipe grasped it. The weapon belonged in his small hand. "He didn't have to cock it back," Pete instructed. "He just had to squeeze the trigger. Pipe would have 9 shots. Pipe wasn't listening. He wanted the gun for himself. Pete seemed to read his mind. "It's yours," he said. He suggested that Pipe change his clothes, and he pulled out some black sweatpants, a black T-shirt, and a black ball cap. They embraced briefly at the front door. Pipe slipped out into the falling dusk, heading east on a path that ran up Story Avenue. Bruckner Boulevard thrummed with commuter cars. At 875 Morrison Avenue, he heard the faint tinkle of laughter and voices near the front entrance. Two blocks down, he saw the lights of the 43rd Precinct. A youth in on the plot with Pete caught sight of Pipe and broke away from the group. He gave Pipe a description of his targets, two brothers, one in a black T-shirt and black shorts, talking to some girls, the other in a white T-shirt nearer the lobby. To Pipe, they looked to be 15 or so, big kids, almost men, much taller than his 4-foot-something frame, as he closed on them. He jerked the gun from his pocket. One of the girls screamed. The brothers ran. Pipe pulled the trigger, and the gun seemed to explode. He pumped off a couple more rounds at the brothers. Each bullet now felt somehow refreshing, the shots driving the stresses and the powerlessness of his life away. As a slight 11-year-old, he always felt that the world loomed large and forbidding. He had no control over his mother's addictions, his forced stays in foster homes. But as the gun snapped in his hand, everything receded. The older kids he was shooting at, the Lafayette Towers, they shrank with each gunshot, while Pipe grew to a colossus. The boy in the white T-shirt jerked back from a round in his shoulder. Another shot or two hit his arm. He slid off a green signpost, and the brothers stumbled together around the corner. Silence. Pipe's shooting arm fell to his side. He rammed the smoking gun back into his pocket. He heard a female voice above and looked up to see a silhouette behind the curtains of a fourth-floor window. Whoever it was knew not to stick her head out. Timidly, she asked if someone had been shot. Pipe hesitated. "I don't know," he said flatly. "I think so." And with that, he turned toward home. He knew from the crime movies he'd watched that when people ran from a shooting, they got caught. He walked slowly and calmly across the concrete running track in the middle of Soundview Park, the barrier between Soundview and the Lafayette Towers, an area everyone avoided after dark. Far behind him, he saw the flickering lights of police cars and heard sirens. As he crossed Metcalf Avenue into the Soundview Project, a wave of exultant, raw power washed over him like nothing he'd ever experienced. If the police came for him here, he would know where to hide, and he knew that the community would protect him. Up on Randall, he saw D-Spot standing outside his Volkswagen Rabbit. The trunk was open, music turned up. A few boys were gathered around, drinking and bouncing to the beat. Midway to his building, Pipe ran into Everton, a hyperactive Jamaican in his early 20s. "What's up, little man?" Everton commented on Pipe's black outfit before describing a confrontation he'd had with a few young kids in the neighborhood. "Them dudes was talking trash," Everton said. "I told him I'll get my little man Pipe to pop one in your ass. I'll give him a gun myself." He collapsed into laughter. Pipe flared with rage at what he deemed disrespect. He wasn't just a kid. As of 10 minutes ago, he was, in the language of the street, a gunbuster. Pulling the gun out of his pants, he held it to Everton's face. It still smelled of freshly burned gunpowder. "You don't need to give me no gun, nigga," stormed Pipe. "I got my own. You don't know me. It ain't no game. I ain't playing." Everton put his hands up. The silence filled with the whine of sirens. The older Jamaican placated him. "You ever need anything, man, just holler." Pipe stalked back to his apartment. In his room, he hid the gun in a plastic toy box under his bed. Roe sat looking at his brother. Pipe told him not to touch it. Roe knew not to ask questions. Pipe went to B. Love's apartment at 1710 Randall and called Pete. "It's a done deal. You good? Call you tomorrow." Pipe left the apartment and went next door to 551, the building on the corner of Randall and Rosedale, where he and the others congregated most days. Inside, he sat on the steps in the stairwell that led to the lobby. 6 months ago, he'd seen his first dead body lying just beyond the door of B. Love's building. The man had been blasted with a shotgun in the stomach and the side of the head. Ambulances and police swarmed the scene. Pipe ran upstairs and told his mother. She'd told him to keep walking when he saw such things and never to get involved. Ever since then, he'd had nightmares. Sometimes he dreamed of the feet of some invisible person making footprints in the carpet near his bed. Other times he dreamed that when he walked past the closet near his front door, an unseen hand dragged him into the darkness. No matter how he struggled, the force always overpowered him. B-Love joined Pipe and offered him a 40. Pipe didn't like that.